Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, Consecrated Life, the Church's life-giving ecosystem. We talk to the Secretary of the Vatican Office, responsible for Institutes of Consecrated Life. And after the Pope sends financial aid to the Horn of Africa, where millions face starvation from drought, we look at the Vatican Office that makes the charitable donations in the Pope's name, many to nations struck by disaster. They're the glue that keeps the church together, the religious and lay people who consecrate their lives to Christ and bear witness to his love through ministry and charity. When most people think of consecrated persons, they think first of religious men and women. But some of our listeners might be surprised to learn there are other forms of consecrated life, such as consecrated virgins and consecrated hermits. Well, I asked the Secretary of the Pontifical Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life, Archbishop Joseph Tobin, what sets consecrated people apart from the rest of the faithful.
Like any vocation, to be a consecrated virgin or a hermit or a Jesuit or a sister of charity, a daughter of charity, ultimately traces its root to the divine impulse, you know, to the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And the Church is sort of the custodian of God's gifts and helps consecrate people who feel this impulse to live it in syntony with the gospel and with the Catholic tradition. So to say that a hermit is a member of the consecrated life, yes, I think that, you know, that stretches it a bit. What is difficult in that case to always to understand is the community dimension, because a hermit by definition
is someone who pulls himself away from society.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But we do, these are ancient vocations in the Church. I mean, the vocation to hermit. In fact, St. Anthony began his life as a hermit, as someone who lived apart. He sold all that he had and provided for his younger sister, which was good of him, and then went out into the desert of Egypt. And there were other people who sort of felt drawn to, by the example of his life, to accompany him. And so the hermit was no longer a hermit. Instead, he had a community of men around him that were, and then later women, who followed his example.
Now, it was Pope John Paul II who instituted the World Day for Consecrated Life back in 1997. In his homily for the very first celebration on February 2nd that year, he said, "The observance is intended to help the entire Church to esteem ever more greatly the witness of those persons who have chosen to follow Christ by means of the practice of the evangelical councils, and at the same time is intended to be a suitable occasion for consecrated persons to renew their commitment and rekindle the fervor which should inspire their offering of themselves to the Lord." Now here we are, 2011, that's some 14 years later, in a very changed world. How do you think Pope Benedict sees this World Day for Consecrated Life?
Well, I think he appreciates the inspiration of his predecessor. I think that it's important to look at the original inspiration of Pope John Paul II, that this was not simply for consecrated people, but it's for the Church. And it's to remind the Church of the presence of this particular vocation, which he judged himself. I think if you read some of his own writing, especially the apostolic exhortation Vita Consecrata, that he saw it as something quite important and one would even say essential for the Church's life. So I think the celebration of February the 2nd was first and foremost for the Church, to remind the faithful of this the beauty, the importance of this vocation.
Now, Pope Benedict himself has likened consecrated life to a plant with many branches. which sinks its roots into the gospel and brings forth abundant fruit in every season of the church's life. But he's also called consecrated men and women a bridge to God for all those he or she meet, a call and a return. What is the Pope, do you think, expecting of the faithful here and the consecrated?
Well, I think that of the consecrated life, I mean, I like his example of the of a plant. I mean, I often speak of it, of the consecrated life as a whole, because in my service to the church, I deal with all a variety of forms of consecrated life, from monks to teaching religious to missionaries to people who live a contemplative or life that is in some way separated from the world. I think of taken together, it is a sort of ecosystem. And like the Amazonian rainforest, it's essential to the larger system of the church. Without that rainforest, we would find it very difficult to breathe because it provides oxygen for the world. And I think in some way the consecrated life should provide this oxygen for the church. Part of it, in drawing on that second, about the bridge example, is to illustrate the importance of God before all else. Because I think if you want to find the common denominator among religious, it's that. I mean, that whatever their particular work may be or their service, pastoral service, it's first and foremost a recognition of the supremacy of God and that everything that we are is conditioned by that. And so that perhaps the freedom, the joy, the hope that we religious find in pursuing our vocation and in recognition of the supremacy of God will also help married couples, single people, young people find joy and freedom and really the correct direction in their own lives.
You know, Pope Benedict also pointed in some of his discourses to cloistered communities as being united to Christ's passion. And this is just one quote from Pope Benedict, taking on themselves the sufferings and trials of others and offering everything with joy for the salvation of the world. But in today's age of 3-second sound bites, iPhones, YouTube, Twitter, some might think that cloisters or these cloistered communities would be passé. Are they?
Well, I don't think so, and I think most of the brothers and sisters that I know that live that particular lifestyle wouldn't think so, and especially the younger members that are attracted by the, I suppose, the depth that one finds in a cloister. Now, the depth is a recognition that reality isn't simply a superficial or passing fad.
I think, and also this Pope reminded us of the importance of silence in our lives. In this world, it is so noisy. So we're bombarded with so many images and sounds. The importance of silence.
I think you're right. And he reminds us in very practical ways, like his own practice and really expectation that other celebrants follow the practice of, after the gospel, of just being quiet for a moment, you know, to allow the Word of God to resonate and speak within us. We are surrounded by a lot of words. And I remember once reading in a manual of management that said, formerly, a practice was to withhold information so you could guarantee your importance in a structure. Now it's simply to bombard people with words, and then no one really knows what's important or not. And I think that silence can help us understand and witness to the one thing necessary.
Now, people were shocked by the clerical abuse, sex abuse crisis, and revelations that the leader of at least one institute for religious life had seriously compromised his vows and the trust of his followers. And here I'm thinking in particular of the Legionaries of Christ. The faithful, many young seminarians and priests have felt, quite frankly, betrayed by those who they once trusted. To what extent have these scandals taken a toll, do you think, on vocations in the church? And do you think enough has been done to purge this behavior from the church and ensure that it never happens again?
Well, there are several questions there. I mean, the first regards scandal. And, you know, Jesus was very, very, used very strong language about scandal. Because I think he knew in his compassionate heart just what damage can be done. The people of this city recognized it millennia ago when they started, had a proverb that said, corruptio optima pessima, the corruption of the best is the worst. And that's exactly true because it leaves people cynical or dubious regarding the authenticity of anybody who tries to do good things. Now, I think in that sense, religious and priests across the world, in my experience, have been touched and hurt by the scandals such as the one you just touched upon because all of us feel a bit suspect, you know. I've also found that if people know us, and they eventually will form their own judgment about whether we're the real deal or not. And I think that the church, both locally and universally, is making serious efforts and progress to ensure that, to the best we can, that scandals don't occur. I don't think we can give 100% guarantee because finally people are free and they're free to choose very evil things. It's my belief, and I'm by nature an optimist, that people don't go out of their way to choose evil. And however, I do believe that religious leaders have a special responsibility to offer a witness that's transparent in all senses of the word. And when we don't do that, the price is very severe. Now, I'm glad to see that, you know, I can speak, for example, of some dioceses in the United States. I understand where there were some very public and damaging scandals, that the vocations to the diocesan priesthood and some religious institutes has not disappeared. I mean, in fact, it's recovered and seems to be going well. But that's not, I'm not Pollyanna. I don't think that, I think that some very severe wounds have been inflicted on the church, and I think the Holy Father is one of the first to recognize that.
And you there at the congregation, are you able to offer any kind of practical support for people, for example, as these seminarians and the legionaries, you know, who've suffered this trauma? Are you able to offer any kind of spiritual, practical support?
Well, I think, you know, if you're speaking about the specific case of the legionaries, the Holy Father has, you know, reached out and both in responsibility to correct the errors, that the sin, the evil that has been unleashed, but also to care for the people who have been crushed and wounded by the evil choices of people they respected in authority. So the Holy Father has provided, you know, a group of cardinals and that are accompanying the legion led by Cardinal de Paulus. For ourselves, we deal sometimes with particular cases of members of a religious order that find themselves in crisis, trying to find a solution that's consistent with the values of the gospel and the church's tradition. We also try to take preventative measures in the sense that when we look at the state of a religious order, you know, its own self-examination, we pay special attention to the formation that's being given to enter the selection of candidates and to ensure that the beauty of that particular vocation is reflected in the care with which candidates are admitted and later formed.
Pope John Paul II suggested that consecrated people not only, and these are his words, have a glorious history to remember and to recount, but also a great history still to be accomplished. He said, look to the future where the Spirit is sending you in order to do even greater things. And Pope Benedict, too, is urging people, it seems to me, to rekindle the enthusiasm for the faith that the first Christian communities enjoyed. And this in a world today where religion is more and more seen as a source of conflict or of division. From here, then, what future for consecrated life?
Well, I you won't be surprised if I tell you that I agree with both pontiffs there. I think the words of Pope John Paul that you quoted to conclude Vita Consecrata are a very salutary reminder to religious who, at times, looking at the limited horizon of their, of this moment of history, may feel very discouraged. And I think they're with reason in some contexts. What are the reasons for hope? Well, I think the reasons for hope is that this finally religious life or consecrated life isn't simply a human project. It isn't that the founders like Saint Ignatius Loyola or Saint Francis de Sales or Dominic or Jean-François de Chantel or any of them sat down and said, you know, I think it's a good idea to found a religious order. It was the impulse of God. It was the work of God in giving a gift to the church. And that's what charism finally means. It's a gift. So to conclude the consecrated life is over, I mean, you'd have to say, well, then God chooses not to give gifts to the church any longer. I mean, this is a gift among other gifts. And so, yes, and I think they're very practical possibilities for the service of the consecrated life to the church and to the world. For example, you mentioned about the marginalization of religion and the growth of division. Well, consecrated life is a reality that goes beyond national borders. I mean, many of the really thriving religious orders and congregations today are multinational groups, multicultural groups. And they're groups that, in my mind, prolong the miracle of Pentecost. Not simply that the good news is heard in all, you know, in everybody's language, but that the good news doesn't require people to forfeit the richness of their own tradition or their culture. And so while it's not always easy, I think at our best, we reflect a Catholic church in a microcosm, that a religious order or religious congregation, while very attentive to the local circumstances, is a reality that also witnesses to the God who loves and enters all of human reality.
And a very warm thanks there to Archbishop Joseph Tobin, Secretary of the Pontifical Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life. It means one heart. That's the translation from Latin of Cor Unum, the pontifical council that coordinates the Pope's charitable contributions to help victims of disasters and fund such projects as combating desertification in Africa and aiding farm workers and indigenous people in Latin America and the Caribbean. The council has given millions of dollars in the Pope's name for victims of earthquakes, flooding, and other catastrophes. The Council is also responsible for preparing the Holy Father's Lenten message each year. Well, Pope Paul VI established the Council in 1971, saying, "A heart that beats in rhythm with the heart of Christ, whose pity for the hungry multitudes reaches them even in their spiritual hunger." Pope John Paul II once told Cor Unum staff,
"You are, in a certain sense, the eye that spots the multiple poverties. You are the heart that has compassion and wants to do for the other who is in need what one would wish for oneself. You are the hand that is stretched out fraternally and gives practical help."
In his encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, Pope Benedict XVI wrote,
"The Church, as God's family, must be a place where help is given and received, and at the same time a place where people are also prepared to serve those outside her confines who are in need of help."
Cor Unum's Monsignor Anthony Figueredo told me more about the Council's activities, including coming concretely to the aid of Haitians who continue to suffer so greatly from a devastating quake that destroyed much of Port-au-Prince in January 2010.
Many people think that we're a fundraising agency, that we collect money and we give it out. That's really not our principal work. The diocese do that very well. I think of Haiti And in the United States, when the earthquake took place in Haiti, the diocese raised an enormous amount of money, which we wouldn't be able to do ourselves. I mean, we're a small office, there's 14 of us here. So how could we possibly raise money for Haiti? So our main work, Tracy, is really to maintain the splendor of Christian charity, and that's through the work of catechesis. So meeting with bishops, because bishops are the first responsible for charity in their diocese, through the ad limina visits, through visits to the episcopal conferences, through visits to the Catholic charitable organizations, through various literature. We're responsible for the Lenten message. So that work of catechesis. On a second level, there are needs. We receive letters from people in need. And then there are the major tragedies, like Haiti, like Pakistan. So whatever need there is placed before us, we assess it and we say, in the name of the Holy Father, can we give a small sign of compassion in his name? I mean, it's not large amounts. I think the amounts are very small, but it means a lot. You know, someone who's in Nepal and needs has had a tragedy, a humanitarian disaster, and receives a letter, receives some very small funding from the Holy Father, it really gives them hope. It opens heaven for them. It gives them an insight into the love of God through the church.
Does Pope Benedict ever get personally involved in any of these projects, or does he step down the road and say, listen, I've got this project in mind and I really want somebody to do something about it?
Pope Benedict's papacy, if we look at his speeches, addresses, homilies, Cantus Firmus, a thread which runs through his papacy, is charity, the need to love God and love our neighbor. So he's very much involved on that level. Whenever there is a major tragedy, he often speaks about this. And he works really through us, asking us to make sure that the needs are met. Sometimes also there are very specific requests made to him. And I have to say that the Holy Father personally sometimes says, I want you to act, to respond in my name to that particular need. So I think on his papal visits, very much, he always, almost always, has a place for those who are suffering. I think in England, he visited an old people's home, you know, in many places in the United States, other places he'd visit children who are disabled. A very key part of the papacy, Tracy, is charity and this love that manifests the charity of Christ. So yes, very much involved, and I think above all, through his own prayer.
It's come out several times, the fact that Catholic charities are able to contribute almost 85-90% of the donations they receive actually to fund the projects. So their administrative costs are very low, and you compare that to some of these big, weighty international organizations, not to name names, but their administrative costs are very, very high. How do the Catholic charities keep their budgets so tight?
I think the key is we have wonderful, zealous, dedicated personnel, workers, many volunteers too. If we look at the Catholic Church, and it's really present in dioceses, we already have a network present. And we still have religious congregations, we still have priests, we still have sisters, we still have lay people dedicated. So many of the new ecclesial movements, communities, are very much engaged in charity and do not do this for themselves, but do it out of love of God. So obviously there is payment for those who have jobs, but they're very often prepared to do this as simply out of the love of their hearts. And the reward is not so much on the monetary level. It's really the reward of serving the other. That's where our happiness lies, Tracy. God made us not to live for ourselves, but to live for the other, to give of ourselves for the other. And that's where we discover the greatest reward, not only in heaven, but in this life. And when people discover that, they're prepared to give everything. One sees the witness of the great saints, you know, St. Vincent de Paul, Mother Teresa, Francis Cabrini, so many of the saints. They gave everything. They left everything for love of God. And, you know, I go and visit the Sisters of Mother Teresa here in Rome. I celebrate Mass. And I've never met people who are so happy. You know, they've never met, and they have very little. Obviously, they don't get paid. They refuse donations in many ways. But they're the happiest people one could meet. Why? Because in giving, we receive. That's what St. Francis says. We need to do that to discover the great reward is the love of God in us.
What are some of the projects? You mentioned Haiti, you mentioned Pakistan. Once a disaster strikes like this,
Is the Catholic Church able to assist these people on a longer-term basis?
Just to give the example of Haiti, when the disaster struck, the Holy Father asked Corunum to coordinate the relief efforts. How have we helped? There's the immediate need. Water, sanitation, preventing disease. So that's an immediate need. There's also the longer-term need, and we've really moved now, even though there are obviously still difficulties. You know, cholera is breaking out there now. But there's a longer-term need of reconstruction. And there were significant funds given to Haiti, never enough. But the issue now is how do we coordinate that reconstruction so it's not just haphazard. So, for example, an agency has just been established by the Haitian Episcopal Conference with the help of other Episcopal conferences, principally the American Bishops' Conference, to coordinate the reconstruction of houses, churches, centers, make sure that the funds that were given generously are put to the best use. So that involves architects, it involves bricklayers, it involves buying the cement, but we need to use wisely what others have given to us. And then, you know, there is an accountability. We are stewards. We need to be good stewards of that which has been given to us, but there also needs to be coordination. And so that's really our work, and so we oversee a lot of that work.
In a country like Pakistan, where we saw the terrible flooding, how do you strike the right balance between, it's a mostly Muslim country, so between witnessing to the Catholic, to the Christian faith, and providing charity in an ambiance which is primarily Muslim or Buddhist, whatever have you?
We meet the immediate need. There's a flood, there are people who are suffering, so charity is not partisan to a religious faith, it's not partisan to culture or color or creed. But every act of charity carries within itself Christ, because charity, it's a Christian term, which means the love of God. Caritas means the love of God. And so when we diffuse that charity, it always carries within itself a message of evangelization. People who saw Mother Teresa saw the love of God. And it doesn't mean we proselytize, it doesn't mean we make them Christians, but already there they meet Jesus, and if that also means that they want to know what gives you your love, well, where do you get it from, what is your source, we are very happy to do that. You know, in the early church, the way people became Christians, converted to the faith in a pagan environment, and we live very much in a pagan environment today, was see how they love each other. They saw what the Christians had, and they wanted it. And so that's our big challenge today, to love our neighbor. That's what makes Christianity different, to love the one who is different to us, to love the one who doesn't share our views, doesn't share our religion. You know, Jesus gave two signs, Tracy, and he says, by this way, people will know you are my disciples. What were the two signs? Love one another as I have loved you. It wasn't simply love one another. As I and Jesus loved to the end on the cross. No other religion loves the enemy as Jesus did. And the other sign, may they be one, Father, as you and I as one. Where there is that unity, what does that mean? Where the other is different to me, I can still be in communion with them. It underlines so much of the church's teaching, for example, on marriage, on disabilities, on euthanasia, on I can still accept the other and give myself to the other, even though they're different to me.
Monsignor Anthony Figueiredo is an official at the Pontifical Council Cor Unum. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.